From the North Carolina Reading Service, this program intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The Indie Week, read by John Federson. This week's issue is dated September the 30th, 2020. Beautiful theme music was provided today by ACE. Of course, that's A-C-E, otherwise known as the Acronym Chamber Ensemble. I know a couple of the members, and so I'm entitled to call them ACE. And we'll hear from them at the close of today's broadcast, which better get started right away. We'll get right to our Voices column entitled Judgment Day, and it's written by Jonathan Weiler, a teaching professor at Global Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Liberals have complained about Republican hypocrisy for decades. I've been one of them. It's time to stop. The premise of such complaints is that two sides are playing a game by a common set of rules, but the GOP stopped playing that game a long time ago. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death 2 weeks ago have touched off the latest round of such hand-wringing. You all know the story. 2016, Justice Scalia died. The Republican-controlled Senate didn't merely reject Obama's proposed nominee to replace him. They refused even to consider him, holding no hearings, let alone a vote. Senate Majority Mitch McConnell and his allies argued that then, with less than 9 months until Election Day, the people should decide who gets to appoint the next justice, determined by whomever wins the forthcoming presidential election. The premise that the president isn't really president in his final year of office is as nonsensical as it sounds. McConnell's decision to replace Ginsburg within weeks of a presidential election confirms that. Liberals have decried this latest bald-faced rejection of a precedent that McConnell claimed as sacrosanct 4 years ago. In the meantime, as McConnell has shown, the only rule that matters is that the composition of the Supreme Court is to be determined by whichever party has the power to do so. By that rule, if Joe Biden does win the presidency and Democrats retake the Senate, the question will be whether Democrats should pack the court. Those who are reticent about reshaping the court fear that to do so would turn it into political football and undermine the stature and credibility of the judiciary, the branch of government typically deemed most immune to the crass realities of politics. Further, it's what authoritarian leaders do, scholars of democratic backsliding warn. On the other hand, many legal scholars have noted that the extensive American practice of judicial review, whereby courts scrutinize and overturn duly enacted laws that are deemed in conflict with larger legal and constitutional principles, is a global outlier. According to this line of thinking, perhaps our courts have too much status and authority to contravene small d democratic will. Let's take one notable example. By a 5-4 vote, the Roberts Court in 2013 gutted the Voting Rights Act on flimsy legal grounds, and that law has been most recently reaffirmed in the Senate by a 98-0 vote. Should courts have the authority to overturn such clear expressions of democratic will, especially on such questionable legal pretexts? Of course, liberals relied on courts for a long time to reject laws they deemed antithetical to their values and interests, and now they face the growing prospect that many of their priorities could meet a similar end. The nomination and certain confirmation of the ultra-conservative Amy Coney Barrett puts Roe v. Wade and the Affordable Care Act in serious jeopardy. That this is a predictable result of the appointment of a new justice belies the idea that justices are neutral arbiters who just call balls and strikes, as Chief Justice Roberts famously avowed during his confirmation hearings in 2005. Indeed, it would be hard to find a more nakedly partisan and political decision than the High Court's 5-4 ruling in Bush v. Gore, in which five Republican justices effectively stopped a legal recount of the vote in Florida in 2000, which essentially handed the presidency to Republican George W. Bush. This is not to suggest that all court rulings equally reflect such nakedly political considerations, but the fact is that the judicial branch, up to and including the Supreme Court, is already political and the least democratically accountable branch of government. A decision to expand the size of the Supreme Court would be a perilous one, not to be taken lightly. But it would also be an arguably long overdue recognition of the nature of the game of judicial politics Republicans have long been playing. When Republican elites respond by decrying Democratic hypocrisy for politicizing the court and unfair power grabs, and of course they will, Democrats need not apologize for having finally caught on. Now, time permitting, we will return to our op-ed column. But first, we'll go to news, this one from Durham by Tomasi McDonald, Summer of Sorrow. Each morning, Laverne Lucier lights small white candles in her son's memorial just around the corner from her South Durham home. Lucier says, "I light the candles each morning because right now, that's my safety net. I feel that's where his spirit lives." It was just after 4 p.m., Monday, August 10th, when police found Lucier's 18-year-old son, Sincere Burrell, mortally wounded by gunfire in his girlfriend's car. The faded burgundy sedan was parked on Lincoln Street beside the First Chronicles Daycare Center, just around the corner from Burrell's home on Linwood Avenue. Paramedics rushed Burrell to a local hospital where he died. The wiry teen's death was the city's third gun murder in Durham that day. It was part of a wave of gang-related gun violence that swept Durham in the summer of 2019 and intensified in the summer of 2020. Last year, one of Burrell's best friends, 17-year-old Zivon Herschel Tucker, was found dead in a churchyard where he was targeted during a drive-by shooting spree that killed one other person and wounded eight more. Now, Lucier says, "I don't know if I'm coming or going sometime with this happening so close to home." The memorial Lucier has created for her son is just a few steps from her front door. It's bounded by a small white picket fence. A fellow church member made a small wooden cross. There's a Winnie the Pooh stuffed animal in red striped pajamas, glass-encased candles, a potted plant with a lone white flower, a blue bandana affixed to a fence post, and solar lights to brighten the newly sacred patch of ground at night. "He didn't like the dark," Lucier says. Burrell graduated from Bull City Youth Build in January and hadn't decided how he wanted to spend his life. He celebrated a birthday on July 9. "He got to be 18 for 1 month," his mother says. She last saw her son alive the morning before he was killed. "I was on my way to Roxborough to see my mom, and he was laying across the futon. I hadn't seen him in a couple of days because he had been with his little girlfriend. I said to him, 'Hey, buddy, you look like you need some sleep. Looks like you got bags under your eyes.' He said, 'I know, Mom.'" As she walked out the front door, Lucier's last image of her son was of him tussling around with his 6-year-old nephew, like they always do. Lucier was still in Roxborough at 3:15 p.m. when Burrell sent her a Cash App request for $10. "The next thing I know," she said, "I knew my daughter called and was telling me, 'Mom, I heard gunshots and they sounded close.' I told her to call 911. She called back and said, 'Mom, it's Sincere.'" The first of the three gun murders that took place that day happened just after 1 a.m. in the West Durham, where police found the body of a 21-year-old Joshua Lindsay lying in the street next to a wrecked SUV pockmarked with bullet holes. Hours later, just after 6 a.m. in the East Durham, police found the body of 48-year-old Reginald Bowling near the intersection of Liberty and Elm. The next month, on Monday, September 14, police reported a drive-by shooting spree over a 24-hour period in East and West Durham that wounded eight people. The victims included two teens, aged 15 and 17, along with a 26-year-old man who was critically injured with a gunshot wound in the head. The shooting spree mirrored a similar rampage roughly the same time last year, when a series of drive-by shootings left two people dead and eight more wounded. On August 18th, the shooting death of 9-year-old Zion Person, shock the conscience of a city where the murder of black men and boys by their peers is all too common. As the Indy reported, Person's death was an avatar of all that has gone wrong in Durham's growth and prosperity. Amid the pandemic, economic uncertainty, and racial protests proclaiming Black Lives Matter, it's been another deadly season in the Bull City, bringing back a perennial late summer question. Why are young black men and boys in Durham shooting and killing one another? Some observers assert that given the systemic oppression they endure, it's inevitable that they would internalize self-hate and turn on themselves. Children have certainly not been immune. Lieutenant Jackie Werner with the Durham Police Department told Indy, "Some of the most recent victims have been innocent children who are our most vulnerable." Police say 11 of the people shot in the city this year were 15 or younger. They include an 11-year-old girl who was riding in the back seat of her mother's car on Guess Road last week when the occupants of two cars were firing gunshots at one another. Police say the child was caught in the crossfire and received a non-life-threatening head wound. Michael Harris, 15, and Tyvian McLean, 12, were less fortunate. On August 23rd, just after 2:45 a.m., police found Harris mortally wounded in an apartment complex in the 200 block of Seven Oaks Road. The teen died a short while later at a local hospital. The month before, on July 15, it was just after 2:30 a.m. when officers responded to reports of gunfire at the Cornwallis Road housing complex in the 3,000 block of Weaver Street. The investigators found McLean and an unnamed adult wounded by gunfire after someone shot into a housing unit where a party was taking place. The adult survived. McLean died 5 years later. His grandmother, Coretta Saunders, during a July 22nd vigil, said, "Black lives matter, but what about Ty's life? We need to be yelling, 'Kids' lives matter.'" Hours before the shooting that took McLean's life, police raced to reports of a shooting in the 200 block of South Benjamin Street. 8 people had been shot, including 2 children, ages 4 and 8. Police say there have been 689 shootings reported in the Bull City this year, compared with 495 during the same period last year. That's an increase of almost 40%. A total of 226 people have been struck by gunfire, compared to 132 last year, an increase of more than 70%. This year, through September 19th, 25 people in the city have died from gun violence, up from 22 over the same period last year. Werner says cities across the nation have been plagued by an increase in violent crime that many link to the issues surrounding a global pandemic. The police spokesperson says the department will beef up its presence in areas that have been more affected by gunfire for a faster response to shootings. Also, the department's violent crimes task force will realign its resources for a more intense focus on shootings. Werner and Mayor Steve Shule say the city continues to struggle with gang violence. They say that part of the challenge is getting witnesses, including the shooting victims, to come forward and help the police apprehend the people who shot them. Folks don't talk because they are afraid of retaliation. Shule says that the issue of gun violence is not solely a policing solution. He thinks the increase in gun crime this summer is related to the reduced presence of Bull City United. That was a Durham County public health initiative that deploys trained violence interrupters and outreach workers. They try to prevent shootings in the moment by mediating potentially deadly conflicts in neighborhoods and following up to ensure that that beef is quashed and does not reignite. They had to be pulled back from their work during COVID-19, Shule says. "I'm convinced that that has been a part of the problem this summer as well." Shule pointed to the, quote, "root causes of crime as inevitable when people feel as if they don't have real investment in their communities." And he says, "Someone with a good job, affordable and excellent medical care, and a safe, warm, affordable home to lay their head every night is not going to be committing gun violence. We have to work toward that every day. Meanwhile, Lucier continues in the quest to give her son's brief life meaning, spending her days trying to establish a scholarship in her son's name at Bull City Youth Build. She says, "He didn't have no wife or no kids, but I have 18 years worth of memories." And we'll have another column from Durham, written by Mary King. Safe as houses. With many young adults struggling to pay rent during the pandemic, a Durham nonprofit is adapting to provide the housing support and mental health resources needed now more than ever. Since June 2019, the LGBTQ Center of Durham's Host Home program has screened and trained community volunteers to host 18 to 24-year-olds, particularly those who are LGBTQ and people of color. As the volunteers provide them with shelter for up to 6 months, the program offers them case management services and connects them with resources like therapy and job counseling in order to help them achieve long-term stability. When the pandemic hit, social worker and host home program director K.C. Buchanan said program staff felt they could not in good conscience ask the community to assume the health risks of opening up their homes, especially to young adults who are trying to go out and search for employment. So the program stopped formally seeking out host home pairings. Buchanan says, "But what we are doing is we will support folks if they come to those matches organically in the community. We had someone recently who came to us and said, 'I've met this person who's going to take me in.' And we decided to jump in and support that match, much like we would any other host home." The program has always prioritized mental health support, contracting therapeutic providers from marginalized groups in order to match the identities and experiences of the participants, Buchanan says. One silver lining of the pandemic is that these providers are now working virtually, so they can see more clients. And with fewer formal host pairings, case managers can take on clients in need of less comprehensive assistance and more individual support, like emotional check-ins or help finding a place to live. This has allowed the addition of 9 young adults to the usual 5-client maximum. The program is receiving many requests for help from young adults facing evictions and aggravating housing instability, particularly from those who are people of color and LGBTQ. Buchanan says they're focused on surviving right now, and that's been a trend since the beginning of this program. Tiz Giordano, a community organizer in Chapel Hill and an essential worker at Weaver Street Market, and their spouse were independently hosting a Latinx trans person when the host home program started up. They were able to transition this young adult into the program so they could obtain the professional support they needed. "Having that available meant so much to me as a community member," Giordano says. Giordano, who has experienced homelessness, said factors that play into LGBTQ housing insecurity include high barriers to support services, racism, transphobia within the LGBTQ community, and families who don't affirm their children's identities. They say, "I didn't know how to write a check until I was at least 27 years old. These things that affirming families teach their children, teach them how to survive in the world, I didn't get those things." Anti-violence advocate Christy Croft said homeless people and LGBTQ people both face an increased risk of sexual violence and trafficking. They say, "So when you put those two together, there's just a lot of vulnerability. And that vulnerability is not because of anything about the individual. The vulnerability is because of our systems not being set up to support people properly." In homeless shelters, LGBTQ people might face homophobic and transphobic bullying from fellow residents, Croft says. Plus, some faith-based shelters don't have an anti-discrimination policy and will only take in LGBTQ residents if they hide who they are. "We need better options," Croft says. Buchanan says the Host Home program is intentionally tailored to the needs of young adults who are queer, trans, and people of color. Buchanan says, I'm very proud of the way that we have stepped in to fill this need, and I just want folks to know that we are here to support every need that we can in the community. Now, in this coming article about the census, names and identifying details have been altered to protect confidentiality of census data. Fred Wasser writes, My census days. It was an odd summer. In the hot and humid days of mid-August, I started driving from house to house counting people. I was an enumerator for the U.S. Census Bureau, and this was the big census that happens every 10 years, the decennial census. The things I carried on my rounds, my government-issued iPhone, my census ID, my census briefcase, various bits of paperwork, and my white cotton mask. Water, too, not government-issued. A daily case list told me the addresses to attempt. At the beginning of one shift, a man came out of his car as I got out of my car. I identified myself as a census worker. I don't want anything to do with you, he said. Get off my property right now. An hour later, I drove up to a house at the end of a long gravel and dirt road. The owner, a retired state employee, told me his name. He put on a mask and invited me inside where it was air-conditioned. We sat at his kitchen table, close but not too close, and filled out his household's census survey. The first U.S. Census was in 1790, led by Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. The population of the United States was 3,929,625. There's something comforting about a number so precise. A more recent estimated total population is 330,359,887, according to the U.S. Census Bureau as of September 22nd. Fun fact, the U.S. population has a net gain of one person about every 16 seconds. Census data are used to allocate federal dollars and determine the number of seats for each state in the U.S. House of Representatives. Census enumerators work in the field trying to find out where you were living on Census Day, April the 1st. Because of the late start due to the COVID pandemic, it's been a race against time. By early September, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, about 80% of North Carolinians had completed their census questionnaire via the phone, internet, postal mail, or in-person visit. As of September 21st, the NC response rate overall was almost 93%. That's good, and it's higher now. But to achieve a fuller count, it could be better in parts of North Carolina and other states. And in fact, a federal court on September 25th ordered the Trump administration to extend the count until the end of October. However, the Census Bureau, seemingly in opposition to that court order, has announced the counting will end on October 5th. Stay tuned. Every day as I made my visit to private homes, apartment complexes, and mobile home parks, I weighed the risk. Mostly, I remembered to put on my mask. Most people answering the door didn't wear a mask, and it felt awkward asking them to do so. Social distancing wasn't easy. But this strange job was also a way for me to make a bit of money in difficult times, at an uncertain career moment. There were moments of frustration, but also sweet moments. People often gave me more information than I needed. A college student told me that she and her housemate were boyfriend and girlfriend on April 1st, but now are just friends. I'm still wondering what happened. Down a long dirt road, David and his wife live together in a cozy, rustic house. They're hidden in plain sight, not far from downtown Chapel Hill. After the survey was complete, David and I talked about this and that. I told him I returned to North Carolina a few months ago from a radio job in Nevada and had noticed that the two states share a don't-tell-me-what-to-do spirit. We both laughed. David told me a little bit about his life's journey, jobs in hardware stores, and the failed business he started and abandoned. Now, he has a new business that's doing well and is more of a passion for him. Every so often, I discovered an abandoned home in a wooded area. At one place, the porch was filled with garbage. I smelled smells I'd never smelled before. My mask didn't help. A short time later, I parked next to a large house you might find on the Maine coast on a rise looking over the ocean. Except there was no ocean. I forgot that it was 95 degrees and I needed a pee, as I was surrounded by several chickens and a rabbit. I was greeted by a woman who smiled and told me the rabbit is named Luna. She thinks you're going to feed her, the woman said. If someone told me E.B. White's Charlotte's Web was a true story that took place here, I wouldn't question it. I went with the flow. It took tenacity to complete most cases, to nail down a census interview. Many people were not home or didn't have time to do the survey, or they were angry. Sometimes I couldn't find an address, or the address didn't exist. Uncertainty was part of the deal. I surrendered to it, or tried to. It didn't help that I'm a worrier. Sometimes, as I drove on a rutted dirt road, I wondered if my 2003 Toyota Corolla would survive. On my rounds, I pondered our lives right now, in light of a contentious presidential election, pandemic, the economy, and the apparent breakdown of civility. I feel the anxiety that a lot of people are feeling. But then, an old, comfortable feeling. It's suddenly sweater weather. And I find I'm hopeful about the world and myself once again. But is it okay to feel lucky or hopeful about my place in the world, given the misfortunes of others? One woman, after answering her census question, told me that she and her little girl entered the United States illegally a year ago. A U.S. immigration attorney wants $12,000 to take her complex case. She has no money, no job, no working papers, no computer, no internet. This woman says she trusts in the Lord that there will be answers. I hope so. To Raleigh now and Lee Tausis, there are no good protesters. In Durham, a small group of protesters gathered on Wednesday night calling for justice for Breonna Taylor, a black woman shot to death in Louisville, Kentucky, in a no-knock late-night police raid after learning that the police officers who killed her would not be indicted in her death. Protests over yet another failure to hold police accountable erupted nationwide, as they had after George Floyd's death and the shooting of Jacob Blake. The Durham demonstrators, mostly white, were clad in black as they marched through the streets of downtown. At some point, the protest turned violent. By the night's end, about 40 businesses had windows broken and the words "Revenge" and "Burn It Down" were spray-painted on the Durham Police Department headquarters. The next morning, Mayor Steve Shule and Police Chief C.J. Davis held a press conference condemning the destruction. Shule said that morning, "The folks who inflicted this damage were white. This is an attempt to co-opt a racial justice movement." 4 days later, protesters gathered in Raleigh Friday afternoon for an anti-corruption rally. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin had already issued an 11 p.m. curfew ahead of the protest, and the windows of businesses downtown had already been boarded back up. Unlike other protests, the crowd appeared closer to dozen than hundreds, and stood socially distant before the courthouse. A series of speakers, mostly black, discussed systemic corruption and called upon city leaders to hold police accountable and make meaningful changes. By sundown, the first group had peacefully dispersed and an eerie calm had set in downtown. Diners sat down for dinner as police in riot gear stood on guard behind barracks set up outside the courthouse and sheriff's office. By 8 p.m., another group of protesters had gathered in Nash Square. Numbering in the hundreds, many white, clad in black, they held Black Lives Matter signs and called for justice. They told everyone with a camera to leave, warning journalists, "Tonight's going to be really bad for you." As curfew neared, the vandalism began, as it has numerous times since May. Windows were broken, fires were set, and 12 people were arrested. Like clockwork, Baldwin and Police Chief Cassandra Deck Brown held a press conference the next morning, praising those who left peacefully and condemning those who did not. Baldwin said, We do not have the ability, nor would we want to stop people from assembling peacefully and speaking, but there were those, mostly white, who used this as an excuse to incite violence and cause destruction of our downtown business community. Any message of support for Breonna Taylor was usurped by protesters who don't care about peace. They came here with a goal of destruction. The subtext is clear. These are the bad protesters. Their intentions were bad. Good protesters don't damage property. Good protesters go home when they are told. But these mayors seem to have lost sight of what protesting is. A protest is not meant to be convenient. If it is, it's more like a parade, with the police there only to control traffic. Protests are not meant to be comfortable. Dawn Blagrove, executive director of Emancipate NC, said it best last week. There is no right way to protest. As an entity, as a state, you do not get to condone state-sanctioned violence and with the very same tongue denounce violence in response to that state-sanctioned violence. Any damage that happens in the street is a result of failure of city actors, state actors, and federal actors to respect black lives and for their failure to create equality in systems. Equity in systems. She continued, when that damage happens, don't look to the people in the street. Look to the people who have the power to keep them out of the street, because those are the people you should be angry with. Broken glass is annoying, sure. Businesses already crippled by the pandemic are dealt a blow that feels like an insult to injury, but these are mere nuisances. Attempting to divide a movement into good and bad protesters loses sight of the fact that the majority of protesters share the same goal, protection of human life and the end of policing above the law. The protesters themselves bucked Shule's claims that they were co-opting the movement. This week, Shule told the Indy he did not mean to, quote, distinguish between good and bad people, but between constructive and destructive action. He says, I believe in the power of civil disobedience and the way it can awaken consciousness, but I think that the destruction that people were making in downtown Durham last week was damaging to our businesses, which are struggling to come back, and also damaging to the cause for which the people who were demonstrating purport to support. Who gets to say which actions are productive to social justice movement and which are not? Should it be the state itself, inconvenienced by the actions of so-called bad protesters? Should it be those good protesters? There are no good protesters, not from the vantage of a corrupt system, either unaware of or undisturbed by its own corruption, set on shielding itself from change. A protester deemed good by the system they are challenging is a contradiction. The Black Panthers were condemned as a violent terrorist organization. In retrospect, whether we disagree or not with their actions, we acknowledge that the Black Panthers were part of the movement. Martin Luther King Jr. believed in peaceful protest. He condemned the violence too, but he also said the conditions that led to the violence must be as vigorously condemned. A riot is the language of the unheard, King said. What is it that America has failed to hear? Let's not forget why the protesters were out there in the first place. Because in the months since Taylor's death, nothing has changed, and her killers walk free. Debbie Matthews now in stories about a gig worker. Good help is hard to find. Food may be necessary to life, but food writers are unequivocally non-essential. I discovered this in late March when the world closed down due to the coronavirus. Food producers and procurers, medical staff, first responders, and especially the guy who drives the toilet paper truck, all are essential. But the writer of an immersive feature about what it's like to spend the day as a candy maker? During a pandemic, not so much. If I'd been furloughed or laid off from a legit full-time job, I could apply for the unemployment insurance that my employer had been regularly investing on my behalf. But the excitement and danger of being a freelance writer comes with no safety net. no sick leave, no profit sharing, and no unemployment insurance. But on March 27th, the National CARES, CARES Act, was signed into law. Not only did it add a supplement to traditional unemployment payments, but it also created a fund to offer payments to workers who work independently on a gig-by-gig basis. This includes entertainers, ride-share drivers, and freelance writers like me. But the path to assistance is Byzantine and shrouded in a clerical fog. There was a phenomenon in the old Soviet bloc nations, a kind of bureaucratic shared pretense. In the U.S., we have a term for it, Catch-22, coined by Joseph Heller in his novel of the same name. It describes a situation where there is no logical route to the desired destination. So both the government and the individual agree to break the rules, but pretend that they're not. If applying for traditional unemployment benefits is rife with this, applying for gig worker pandemic unemployment assistance, PUA, is a minuet of charades and artifice. The feds have mandated that before one can apply for the gig worker benefits, one must apply for and be denied regular unemployment payments. The State Division of Employment Security's relationship to the unemployed is complicated at best, adversarial at worst. John Quinterno, a principal with South by North Strategies Limited, a Chapel Hill-based research consultancy specializing in economic and social policy, has written about the politics behind the challenges of the system. In 2013, the Tom Tillis-led state legislature completely restructured the system with one overt goal: to pay back the state's rainy day fund, which had been drained through the 2008 recession. They did this through draconian cuts to benefit eligibility, amounts, and durations. While these cuts did position North Carolina's unemployment support systems among the least meaningful in the nation, they had achieved three classic Republican talking points. Restricting benefits saved the state $4 billion and repaid the emergency fund. It funded massive cuts to business taxes and the labyrinthine applications process for extremely limited returns strongly discouraged the newly unemployed to persevere through the process. Once I was turned down for the traditional UI, which, with the restrictions of implemented by Tillis's legislature, was not hard to do, I was permitted to apply for PUA. The earliest date applications for participants were accepted was April 24. I applied for state UI that day and was denied within 48 hours, before applying for PUA April 27th. The application uses the template from the state unemployment application. Because of this, most of it is not compatible with the situation of a non-traditional worker. A PU applicant, by definition self-employed, must present as both worker and employer, which doubles the process. Because this is a new program, there is very little cogent direction on the website. There's a chat function and a phone number for a help desk, but they both come with coronavirus-related issues. Before the pandemic, DES had a staff of 500. The department has increased the number by 2,500, which, quote, includes permanent DES staff, temporary employees, employees from other state agencies, and contracted call center agents, unquote. While there now is a staff of 3,000, hold time to speak with a rep can sometimes be as long as 5 hours. There are also multiple levels of reps, and calls can sometimes be rerouted 3, 4, or even 5 times. The numerous transfers often mean dropped calls. One then has to decide whether or not to restart this hellish marathon from the beginning. Utilizing the phone and online chat for help is eerily, frustratingly similar to calling the cable company during an outage. Each rep has a different explanation of a problem and a different solution, especially for PUA assistance. DES says the average wait for PUA decisions to be made and funds to arrive is 7 to 14 days, and that 520,000 individuals have applied for federal PUA funds. As of August, 200,000 have had their applications approved. After 15 weeks of waiting and letters to both my senators, congressmen, and all of my state reps, I still had no decision. I finally wrote to Pryor Gibson, the assistant secretary for the Division of Employment Security. Within a week, I had a decision. On August 2nd, my original application was denied. That adjudicator turned me down because, inexplicably, they declared my work stoppage was not the result of COVID-19. Despite my sending notes on three stories I'd been working on and emails putting those pieces on indefinite hold during the pandemic. After going through another multi-layer process, I was given a date for a phone hearing on September 21. After 40 minutes, I was denied, with no further right of appeal. Despite there being no federal or state guidelines as to income for qualifying for PUA, my referee, and that's what they're actually called, stated my work doesn't bring in enough to count. And now, for as much time as I have, the cover story entitled The Hedge Maze, written by Matt Hartman. You have only to glance at the 27-story One City Center and dozens of new condo complexes to see that Durham has entered a new phase of development that few would have predicted at the turn of the millennium. But the powers behind those changes, the developers that fund and profit from gentrification, are much harder to see, despite the immense control they wield over the city's future. Their influence is only likely to grow. An analysis of property ownership records from the past property ownership records from the past 20 years shows the new power brokers are increasingly large investment firms based outside of North Carolina, and the city has little power to regulate their influence. In 2000, 65% of the land at Durham that's used for commercial purposes, including offices, restaurants, and other buildings, as well as apartment buildings, had an owner that lived in North Carolina, according to the contact address listed on the deed. More than a third lived in Durham itself. But today, more than half of those commercial properties have an out-of-state owner. Less than a quarter have an owner in Durham. The trend is particularly stark with apartment buildings. Around 75% of the city's apartment units have an owner based outside of North Carolina. Though the trend isn't visible in residential properties like condominiums and single-family homes, only 3% of residential land has an out-of-state owner in 2020, that doesn't account for the role developers have played in which homes are built. Individual out-of-state developers like Virginia's McCann Realty Partners and Ohio's Epcon Communities own hundreds of units at a time, so their influence remains long after ownership has changed hands. And corporate companies renting single-family homes are a growing force in the market. California's American Homes for Rent owns over 200 houses in Durham. Mayor Steve Shule says, "It influences our ability to create our own future as a city. Every dollar that goes to an outside corporation is a dollar that leaves Durham. For the new investors, that's by design. Many of them, especially for apartment buildings and other residential complexes, are large, national or international hedge funds and property management firms with dozens of holdings in search of attractive new markets. In turning to Durham, they're changing the makeup of the city. The new decision makers are companies like Miami's Rialto Capital Management. Launched as part of one of the largest home building companies in the nation, Lennar Corporation, Rialto is now part owned by Connecticut's Stone Point Capital. It claims to control over $100 billion in assets, specializing in dislocated real estate markets expected to develop in the coming years. The investment firm began buying property in Durham in 2016 and currently owns 444 parcels of land in the city. Because these investors tend to be a maze of hedge funds and holding companies, ownership records almost certainly undercount the influence of out-of-state firms. The company leading the redevelopment of Northgate Mall, for instance, is a North Carolina-based property management firm called Northwood Raven, which also owns four apartment buildings in the city. But one of the companies that founded Northwood Raven, the vertically integrated real estate company, Northwood Investors, has offices across the United States, United Kingdom, and Luxembourg, and claims Northwood Raven's properties as part of its own portfolio. The fact that Charlotte is a national banking headquarters further complicates the situation. Many companies that are technically based in North Carolina are better thought of as regional or national development firms. Take the other founder of Northwood Raven, Raven Partners LLC. Headed by David Raven, the former head of a Charlotte-based Croslands residential division, the company consists of, quote, Croslands former residential development and construction teams, which had built, quote, more than 20,000 multifamily units across the Southeast, according to a 2011 press release. However, local ownership alone isn't enough to ensure that Durham residents have a place to live in the city. Shewell says local developers weren't building any affordable housing. That hasn't changed with the advent of out-of-state developers. They were building market-rate housing, and unless we've had some leverage, that's what we've seen, no matter who's been developing. Rather, the problem is that the little leverage the city and its residents have is disappearing with changes in ownership trends, especially for the 46% of Durham residents who rent their homes. Mel Norton, a housing activist, says multifamily properties are real cash cows. He's a housing activist, Durham for All board member, and operations director of the Carolina Federation. Disclosure, this author is also a Durham for All member. Using their immense capital, these investors are seeking dependable revenue streams and participating in what Norton calls new forms of accumulation, turning Durham's growing popularity into various kinds of financial implements that build wealth for the global 1%, thanks to increasing rents, noxious fees, and strict policies. The very fact that out-of-state owners are based elsewhere creates formidable obstacles for tenants trying to resist that process. Durham City Council member Jillian Johnson says a local firm is going to be much less likely to do something that makes a lot of people in Durham angry because that directly affects their standing in their community and therefore their bottom line. An out-of-state landlord, though, is insulated from community ire. If you don't pay the rent, there's nobody to appeal to, nobody to protest, Johnson says. Research by Ekim Boyuk for DataWorks NC backs Johnson's point. Boyuk found that there have been increases in eviction rates in large corporate apartment buildings in the past few years, even as the overall eviction rate in the city has decreased. Boyuk also notes that those corporations were increasingly based elsewhere. Norton adds, we need more research to better understand the impact. She says, what we're still trying to figure out is what the relationship between the increase in out-of-town and corporate ownership in property and things like maintenance of property. What's the human impact of this shift? What's already clear from DataWorks NC's other research is that it's the scale of corporate investors that sets them apart from local landlords, even if they are equally profit-driven. Tim Stallman, a worker owner at Research Action Design, which works with DataWorks, says they are trying, and really explicitly so, to achieve the maximum increase in rent with the minimum increase in maintenance. With so much capital and property to manage, that means prioritizing quick, efficient turnover to reach maximum occupancy at the maximum rent. To do so, Stallman says they use new practices that squeeze tenants to the breaking point, like setting rent by algorithm and using large databases to blacklist tenants who have previously been evicted. Affordable housing advocates are trying to push back by increasing awareness of these practices and tenants' legal rights. DataWorks, for instance, is gathering evictions data in real time for outreach to tenants who are at risk, as well as building public data sets for the Durham Neighborhood Compass so that information is more readily available. But that only goes so far, as tenant protections are slim. North Carolina laws means there's little the city or county can do policy-wise to directly address the trend towards conglomerate out-of-state owners. Johnson says we have very little control generally over any kind of private land transaction. The state of North Carolina has very strict restrictions on what local governments are able to do to regulate their housing markets. The obvious policies other cities around the country use to protect affordable housing are illegal at the local level. A 1987 state law prohibits North Carolina cities from passing rent control. The city lawyer has advised that inclusionary zoning policies requiring developers to build affordable housing are illegal. And attempts to skirt the legal issues proved completely ineffective in Chapel Hill. And the state constitution's uniformity clause prevents local governments from taxing certain kinds of property, like buildings over a certain size, at a higher rate. The one property local government does have is its zoning authority, which it recently used to stop a new unaffordable development in Bragtown. In theory, it could place strict restrictions on what kind of buildings can be built, then negotiate for affordable housing concessions in return for granting developers the right to build something in excess of those limitations. But that approach makes development slow and expensive, increasing the cost of building everything. Johnson says, we have an affordable housing shortage that's most intense, but we have an overall housing shortage too. If we were to do that, I worry the market would get out of whack. Instead, the city's predominant approach has been to facilitate affordable housing projects itself. But Durham's new landlords have shifted the market in ways that make those solutions increasingly difficult, too. In the past, the city relied on funding from the federal low-income housing tax credit, which provides a credit of either 4 or 9% of the construction cost in return for guarantees on affordability. Increased costs mean those credits aren't enough anymore. Shewell says, the land is much more expensive, and it's really hard to do a 4% tax credit deal, which used to drive a lot of these mandatorily affordable units. To fill the gap, the city of Durham has created two of its own funding sources. The first dedicated housing fund in the state, which raises about $6 million a year from a 2-cent tax. And the $95 million affordable housing bond passed last year, which is the largest in North Carolina history. Those funds support a variety of programs for low-income housing, including emergency rental assistance, tax abatement programs, and eviction diversion efforts. They also go to other affordable housing developers. The city helps pay for repair and upkeep on Durham Housing Authority properties, something especially important after the carbon monoxide leaks at McDougal Terrace, the largest of DHA facilities. Johnson adds that few cities offer that kind of support. Most housing authorities are entirely funded by the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development, whose requested budget was slashed by $8.6 billion for fiscal year 2021. The city also created a loan program to support nonprofit affordable housing developers who can't match the speed with which investment firms can buy up property given their deep pockets. But it's not enough. While the city's housing funds, combined with the fact that DHA owns a substantial amount of land around downtown, means the city can build thousands of units of affordable housing, Shewell says, that's not going to nearly stem the tide. Rialto and Northwood Investors alone claim to have raised $16 billion in funds, over 168 times more than Durham's affordable housing bond, and over 31 times more than the city's entire budget. Johnson says, we could put our entire city budget into housing and it wouldn't get us where we need to be. The problem will exist as long as we depend on for-profit developers. Johnson says this is just the natural result of a consumer market for housing. As rising prices elsewhere in the country make Durham a more attractive place to live, the increased demand will continue to attract out-of-state investors who see Durham as a profit maker. This problem can't be solved without significant shifts in power at the state and federal levels. Shewell says legislative change will be important, and that won't change until we have a different legislature. Norton agrees, arguing the city needs increased authority to be able to make a real dent. She says, I think having a legal and enforcement framework that allowed more agency and discretion at the local level and the state level would be really valuable. But we just don't have the political power right now. Even worse, while breaking the right wing stronghold on the legislature in November is essential, it may not be enough in the long run, given the influx of national and international capital. So far, Durham's new class of investors hasn't thrown its full weight into local and state politics, but that may be because they don't need to. Johnson says, given North Carolina's political situation, there's not really anything we can do to stop them. If the balance of political power changes and those interests do get involved, they'll prove another large roadblock for affordable housing. Norton says the real estate lobbies tend to be very powerful. The property rights lobbies tend to be very powerful. None of this is good news for Durham residents. The city already had the highest eviction rate in the state, and now that COVID-19 is decimating incomes, especially for low-wage service workers, there is a catastrophic evictions crisis on the horizon. Getting through the short term will be hard enough, but the long-term changes in property ownership mean a further erosion of local control, which places any lasting solution even further out of reach without substantial, long-term, statewide organizing efforts that can build a new base of progressive power. Well, there are several articles, again, I could not get to complete today's Indie Week. They include an op-ed concerning the Beacon of Freedom Park in downtown Raleigh, a reminiscence and lament for the K&W cafeteria chain, theater and music reviews, and a short piece about Jim Beal, a pumpkin sculptor who is appearing on the Food Network Halloween Wars program, which airs Sunday at 9 p.m. But as you can hear, our acronym chamber ensemble is signaling again the closing curtain for our show. But rest assured, if you wanted to, you could hear it all week, and you'd find that in the podcast section of our website. And that website, ncreadingservice.org. And thanks to their acronym chamber ensemble, and farewell to you from John Federson. Until next issue of Indie Week.